The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the second week of the Edinburgh International Book Festival. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. Today, we're going in search of the open Celtic air, north to the highlands of Scotland and west to the hills and beaches of County Sligo in Ireland. First, we're going to meet Kirsty Gunn, whose new novel, The Big Music, takes its structure from classical bagpipes, as she explained to Charlotte Higgins.
Yes, it's based on the pibroch, which is the most formal kind of bagpipe music there is, and a lot of people don't know about it. Bagpipe music divides into ciall beg, which is small music, and ciall mór, which is the big music, which is the title of my book. And ciall beg is light music, it's for dances and strathspeys and gatherings. Ciall mór is for great and grave and solemn occasions. Tends to be a lament or a salute, and it's long and formal and very complicated and has a very lovely structure, which takes in an erla, which is a ground movement, where we get all our kind of musical ideas and all our themes are established. And then there are a range of variations that are developed on that ground. And then we return, and the music becomes more and more complicated and interesting. And then we return at last to the ground again. So it makes a kind of a circle.
And why, Kirsty, did you find that you needed to shape a book into this particular structure, which is, you know, it's a non-literary structure, it's a musical structure, it's doing something quite different from a normal narrative arc that we might think of?
Absolutely. I think on the whole I'm kind of bored rigid by narrative lines, and I certainly go rushing from the room when I hear that ghastly phrase, the narrative arc. Oh my Lord, when you feel the cavalry riding over the hill that carries with it the entire plot, the backstory, and yes, the inevitable conclusion. These kinds of things make my blood run cold. I've always been interested in the lyric novel, you know, the great modernist project where we take in words, where we make something in words, we create a place in words, and we create a sound in words. So I think if anyone who knows my work was to look back across the landscape of it, I love that thing that Raymond Carver says, look back across the life and see the work. If you were to look back across the landscape of all my books, you would see I've always been concerned with taking the reader to a place that sounds and is sensed and is experienced, but not read. So in this book, I'm taking that project and it perhaps reaches its fullest expression because I've used it literally as my form and structure.
And your father was a piper, Kirsty, and this book, I think, is dedicated to your father. And the sound of this pibroch has been in your life, all of your life.
Yes, I mean, that's certainly the case, that the pibroch has been there sounding in the background of my life. But can I also take this question as an opportunity to talk about something that I care about very deeply, which is that I think a lot of writers have this notion of research. Oh, you know, I'm going to go off and I'm going to research something, and then I'm going to make a book about it. Now, that's fine, and it gives us a particular kind of book and so on. But there's another kind of book that has at its heart a reality. And it's something that's always been present. In a way, it was there before the book was even written, in a kind of mysterious, psychic way. And that gives the book a sort of an imperative, I think. It sets up a kind of an engine in the book. And certainly, I think, when I look across all the works of fiction that I love and admire and return to, they all have this psychic imperative. It's not something they've just simply gone off and, you know, discovered, got the facts together in the London Library. It's something that's deeply known to the writer.
Let's talk about reality in a slightly different way. This book purports to be, in some sense, is an articulation of real things. At the end of the book, there's almost 100 pages of appendices. We have maps, historical information, plans, definitions, family papers. There's a sense that this book has grown out of real archival material.
Well, I've just been talking this morning at my event at the Edinburgh Festival about my understanding of all books, whether they are fiction or a collection of poetry or a work of non-fiction, have to have this quality of being real. Now, by that, I mean they have to be properly made and they have to be fully themselves. They have to be fully formed from within. And everything has to be right. There can be no shoddy mistakes. There can't be a moment where the writer loses interest or ceases to pay attention. At that point, the book becomes as real as any life experience itself. And I've had a lot of people saying to me, oh, but, you know, is this bit real? What was the real bit and what's the made-up bit and so on? Well, in actual fact, everything that happens between the covers of The Big Music is real. You open the cover of the book and it's as though you're going, you're opening a door and going into a place and you stay there and everything that happens in that place is happening to you.
Which, of course, is what happens in any great work of fiction. You go into, if you're reading War and Peace, you go into a place and you exist in that place and the rest of the world does not exist. But you're, as it were, showing those workings a little bit. You're making that suggestion a bit more overt. But I wanted also to talk to you, Kirsty, about the idea of landscape, which not only the idea of entering the landscape of the book, but also the fact that your book is set in a very particular landscape in Sutherland, in the far north of Scotland. It's about a family. The family name is Sutherland, so it's almost like they are absolutely rooted into that physical space. Can you talk about why that patch of Scotland, why that place, and how that landscape infects what's between the covers of the book?
I have to say, first of all, that you're absolutely right. The place is real, and I use that in my book. And this is the first time I've ever done that in any of my works of fiction. I've always, the landscape of the book has always been a very important part of the story. The landscape, some critics have said, is almost a character in my books. Now, in this book, we have a real place, but it's also an imagined place. And yes, there are real place names that I record in the pages, but there are also imagined places. So that's very much part of my project as well, to meld the real and the imagined. I read something recently by Kundera where he says the novelist makes the work out of the rubble of his home. And this is a perfect way of describing, I think, the kind of project I've been engaged in, because I am deeply homeless. I have a kind of synthetic sense of self in terms of nationhood, you know, born in New Zealand, Scottish family, this kind of betwixt and between status. And I think, and also to quote the great Virginia Woolf, although badly, I am a woman and an artist. That makes me an outsider. So I have this sense of statelessness, literary and politically, one might say. But from that rubble, one constructs a land. You know, Edward Said says, the writer makes his home in words.
Kirsty, one of the pieces of material in the appendices of the book is a piece of manuscript, music manuscript, and it's a piece of music. And I think that piece of music has an existence outside the book, because I think your father wrote it.
My father's a piper, and that makes him very awkward. All pipers are. They are cram full of this esoteric musical knowledge. I asked my father years ago, you know, when I was starting to write the book, could he provide me with a few bars of music? I wasn't going to ask for a full pibroch at this point, but could he get a bit of music together that would help me, just as I was writing, create the intervals and so on? To give the sound of the book as it's playing in this central character's mind. No, he'd have nothing to do with it. That's not what, you know, that would be far too self-aggrandizing. No real piper would compose in this kind of way. There's this enormous humility and kind of self-effacement that goes with the piping world. So nothing to do with it. 7 years later, after the book was written and I was now preparing it for publication, going through these mounds of papers, my father presented me with a full pibroch, and I had it on a disc, and I sat down and played it, the intervals that he'd written, and the music, and the themes that he was exploring matched entirely my book, without him having seen a single page, or me having talked to him at all about it, because he's not a reader of fiction.
Thank you. it's a form of music that is to be heard in the landscape and might even sculpturally suggest a landscape in a certain way.
Definitely, it's music to be played outside. And that's why it kind of fell off the table, you know, because as music was brought indoors, as we had started to have harpsichords and chamber music and so on, it became kind of culturally acceptable. And music that was played outside became the music of the lower orders. And so that is why we have in the Highlands, and now, you know, there's a kind of diaspora of pipe music throughout the world, but that is why this particular form exists with such limitation, because it, on the whole, it can't be played inside. And it sounds the most beautiful when it's played out on a hill or in an open space. Having said that, there are a lot of very good places with the right kind of acoustic where a pibroch sounds fabulous.
And why do we know so little about pibroch? As you say, it's a form that doesn't... I mean, we know about the sonata and the concerto, and from your remarks on the pibroch, this is just as complex and formally stratified, formally sort of prescribed, and therefore, I would say, interesting form as these complicated forms of what we would call Western classical music. Why are we English people so unutterably ignorant about these wonderful northern forms?
Well, I think in part it might be to do with the sheer kind of performativity of it. In many respects, most serious pipe players, certainly of my father's generation, kind of disparage the concept of the recording. The idea is that you're there to hear the music as it's being played, and you hear it with the musician who's playing it at the time, and then this sense of the experience of the performance goes into the memory bank. That's not to say the music isn't enjoyed amongst pipers. There's a wonderful form of teaching called Kantorach, which my father and his generation fear is kind of fading away, which is that all the great tunes are taught by ear. So every note has a sound, and the pibroch is sung through from teacher to pupil. Now, for a long time, these things weren't even written down. It took the 19th century to bring us a printed pibroch. So I think this tradition of one-off, the single performance, and the kind of vulnerability that comes with that. It's a beautiful thing to hear pipe music being played in competition, because the piper will stand and deliver this music. The minute there's the tiniest note that's been missed or smirred, as they might say, they'll leave the stage. They never continue.
The stakes are really high then. But you make it sound like oral poetry. You're making it sound like Homeric poetry being passed on through the generations or something, which is a kind of fascinating idea. And I guess most of us hear piping just done really badly, because that's the sort of street corner bagpipe busker is not at all what you're talking about.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, so many people say, oh, I've heard the pipes and they're awful. Well, that is because they have heard them and they are awful, because most people are playing them very badly, as you say, on Waverley Bridge. But the fact is, there are wonderful musicians playing very beautiful music, and you're quite right to identify it with a particular kind of Highland vibe. I learned last night at an event, Angus Peter Campbell, who just won the Poetry Award for the Scottish Book of the Year, was telling us about a Gaelic poem that exists that must be sung and spoken. The poem goes on for 4 days and 4 nights. I mean, all I want to do now at this festival is get hold of that man and find out what that poem is. The hills only come back the same, I don't mind. And all the flat moorland and the sky, I don't mind, they say. And the water says it too, those black falls that are rimmed with peat. And the mountains in the distance to the west say it, and to the north. As though the whole empty, wasted, lovely space is calling back at him in the silence that is around him, to this man out here in the midst of it, in the midst of all these hills and all the air, that his presence means nothing, that he could walk for miles into these same hills in bad weather or in fine, could fall down and not get up again, could go crying into the peat with music for his thoughts, maybe, and ideas for a tune, but none of it according him a place here amongst the grasses and the water and the sky. Still, it would come back to him the same, in the silence, in the fineness of the air. I don't mind, I don't mind, I don't mind, is what there is to begin with. Where did you find him? He starts to say, but Margaret's pulling him inside against the cold and this noise, the sound of the animals at their enclosure. Then she closes the door behind him. He'd not gone for a walk, you see, she says then, and suddenly it's very quiet. He was far away, Callum, high up in the hills. She waits a couple of seconds. For the best part of the morning, she says. He must have taken himself off at dawn, Ian thinks it must have been, for he'd gone a fair distance before he got to him. And the weather had turned, you can feel it now, winter's on its way, and worse, for he had with him... She goes before him, opening the kitchen door that leads from the little hallway. Well, she says, you'll find out soon enough, I suppose. Helen, she holds the door open for him, looks at him. What? We couldn't tell your mother that part, though, she'd worry. And Helen, what about Helen? But by now they're inside the kitchen and it's bright and strange all at once to be inside and in the warm. Callum feels faint suddenly with it, the lights on everywhere and hearing Helen's name. What about Helen? What was it that Margaret said about Helen? Here we are, Margaret is saying to him, and he realises to Ian where Ian is sitting at the table with the guns and a bottle of whiskey and a tumbler set before him. He looks up at Callum, nods. Callum, Ian... And there's a pause then, like there's always a pause, as though the time between when he last saw Ian was nothing, as though the drive up here was no distance at all, as though it makes no difference at all, actually, whether Callum was here or not, as though nothing makes any difference, yet Helen, there was her name. What about Helen? Twice, Margaret saying her name and nearly saying something but not saying it, Helen... Helen, like Callum would say her name 100 times over and still be wanting to say it. Helen, Helen, Helen. But instead he says, how are you, Ian?
That was part of a lament played by Kirsty's father, R.J. Seagun. Now to Ireland and Kevin Barry. He's been recommended to me by many, many people recently for his edgy stories. But he's new to me, so I asked him, bluntly, where he's been hiding all my life.
I've been living in a swamp in County Sligo for the last long while, 5 or 6 years, writing my stories. The worst possible outcome is to be a writer's writer, I think, and not a reader's writer. But no, it's great to get other writers liking your work and stuff. But it's been a good year. I won a kind of a high-profile story competition earlier in the year, which gave the new collection, a good blast, you know, and got a good coverage and so forth.
So this collection's called Dark Lies the Island, and for a man who lives in County Sligo, it's pretty cosmopolitan.
Yeah, I've moved about a great deal, I suppose, in my life. I think at one point I counted 16 addresses in a 14-year period, so back and forth between Ireland and the UK and in the US for many, many long stretches, and in Spain. So I've moved around a lot. I've only settled, really, in Sligo the last while because... the books got too cumbersome to carry around, you know. There was about 68 crates of books that needed a house, so I bought a house for the books, and I'm relatively settled now, though I still travel a bit, and it all feeds into the work and feeds into the writing, and it's a good thing to move about a bit for the stories, you know.
You haven't mentioned Berlin, and one of the stories is set in Berlin, among a sort of art house crowd, a sort of clubbing scene, really. You evoke, is it?
Yeah, the story Berliner Koneplatz, My Lesbian Summer. It's my lesbian story. It's about a young Irish wannabe writer, really, who falls in love with a beautiful lesbian lady, and they have something like an affair, but he doesn't quite work out as a lesbian. It comes very much out of place. I think summer 09, my wife and I went and rented a flat in Berlin, tormented by the Irish rain storms that dominated our summer there. So we went for a couple of months, and it's all set around the square where we lived, you know, and it's a really interesting city now, a city in flux with sort of artists and writers coming in from all over. So it was very tempting to set a story there.
And the woman who he wants to have an affair with is a Serbian art photographer, and she's very wild.
Yeah, I mean, what's so important always in a short story is what you omit and what you leave out and what you leave for the reader to intuit, if you like. So we don't quite know that she's a Serb or something like that. I'm delighted that you got that and you got a lot of her background, where it isn't quite told in the story. It's kind of shown in the background, kind of sort of haze of the story, like, and it comes through in the detail. A story it seems to be working for me when I can hear the characters very quickly talking to each other on the page, when they won't shut up, if you like. And Sylvia and this sort of young Irish innocent seem to me to be alive, you know, very quickly. And that's a sign that I'm going to hang on to a story and make it work. Because, you know, they're really difficult. Short stories are bloody hard, and most of them end up going wrong on you and falling off your desk and ending up in pieces on the floor. So it's always an exciting thing when one out of a dozen or one out of a ten, and it's that kind of a strike rate for me when one works out, you know, and the Berlin story seemed to be there for me. What's so important is to write lots of them and to treat it as a craft thing, almost like an artisanal craft. It's no coincidence that the very greatest story writers at work now are the ones who keep writing stories and stick with the form and put out collection after collection after collection. People like William Trevor or Alice Munro, who show a lifetime dedication to short story writing, which is what it merits and deserves, and I certainly intend to do the same.
But you've written a novel in between. You've written two collections of short stories, and then The City of Bahan, which was the one that really drew you to everybody's attention, wasn't it?
Well, I see them as quite distinct for me. The novel for me is a place to really experiment and to try things. So City of Bohan is a kind of a deranged, futuristic, non-techno-Irish future city where people are obsessed with knifing each other and with clothes. When I have an idea, and I'm lucky enough to have a relatively fluent imagination and ideas come, I would say that usually my first impulse is to say, can I reduce this so that it'll work in a short story space? And so maybe it is my first love as a form, but I certainly intend to do the two, and also to write for actors. I work a little in theatre in Ireland, and also writing film scripts, and I'm kind of a frustrated actor myself, and I have a great empathy with them.
One of the interesting things about the collection is it's not always about people talking to other people, is it? So the opening story, Across the Rooftops, is about a young man dramatising the difference between what he wants and what he can actually do in his first sort of romantic entanglement with somebody.
So it's set on a rooftop in Cork City on a beautiful summer's morning after a party, and it's basically a young man and a young lady trying to negotiate a snog, and he's making an absolute very poor fist of it. And sometimes a very simple story like that, a very simple setup, will work on the quality of its close description, and it just has to proceed sentence by sentence, and you've got to get all the detail exactly right.
But she doesn't have a voice, does it? It's all the dramatisation is between his actions and his thoughts.
It's very much in close description of what their bodies are doing as this all goes awry. You know, I've been there, I've made many a poor fist at an attempted snog with a young lady in my day. So it's a story that seems to have resonated actually with lots of young men and lots of young ladies, so it's that's always nice when you've got on caught on something that's universal, you know.
And the other story that I was very affected by was the young girl who's deciding whether to cut herself again. She's a cutter, and she's alone in her father's home, and he's left the kitchen knives. She has a dialogue with a website, and she has a phone conversation, but again it's an internal monologue that's going on, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the title story, Dark Lies the Island, and it was an incredibly difficult story to write because I write probably quite bleak, dark comedies, but there's no comedy in this particular story. It's very dark, she's very troubled, It took many, many drafts. There were 25, 30 drafts of this story. And I just couldn't go with them because it had a very dark finish. It had an inevitable finish, a bloody finish.
So you're saying that the ending as it stands is a cop-out in some way?
It's what I had to go with at the time. I wanted to leave some chink of hope in there. I don't know, I remember the great Irish story writer Frank O'Connor said, right, that he often went back to his collections of stories and started rewriting them after they'd been published, and thinking that was a little extreme. But now you can almost see it. I'm very pleased with the story because I think that girl is very much alive in our minds. I think she's very palpable. I think her situation is very palpable.
Who are the greats? If you were a young short story writer wanting to start out, who should you be reading?
I've always had a huge affinity with the great English story writer V.S. Pritchett, who's sadly kind of gone out of fashion. But Pritchett worked with the ear. He worked so much from human speech and from the vagaries and madnesses concealed in our speech. I recognise a kindred spirit in that. So Pritchett has always been very important to me as a story writer, and I'm determined to bring him kicking and screaming back into the limelight. I think he will come back, because I think his collected stories is one of the great, great all-time books of stories.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't you Brits feel like celebrating those 14 days of sporting glory? Of course you do. So why not do it with a strictly unofficial but suitably stylish Philosophy Football Design t-shirt? This unique t-shirt is a wearable, chronological and color-coded record of an unforgettable fortnight. And for Guardian and Observer podcast fans, we have a special offer of £3 off and free post and packaging. Curious? Well, to see how good this unique t-shirt looks and to take advantage of our listeners' offer, just go to guardian.co.uk/podcastoffers. I dare you.